So have you been to many of these places that you have maps for?
No.
Have you tried following the map?
No, actually, I haven't. I have to concede I've never had a chance to travel in China. One day I will have to follow the course of some of these rivers, that's for sure. My name's Floyd Sully, and I have collected these maps for about 15 years. Maps and texts. There's a lot of interesting texts as well on mathematics and astronomy and whatnot.
Find somewhere that's not too loud.
My name is Walter Davis. I'm an art historian. I teach here in the Department of Art and Design and in the Department of East Asian Studies. And I specialize in Chinese and Japanese art, early modern and modern, which is why I was asked to curate the exhibition. One has to see them to believe them. One of the nice things about Floyd Sully's collection and about the exhibition is that there are maps from multiple traditions. There are maps from China, there are maps from Europe, there is a map from Japan, all of which have a common subject, China. And there are very different cartographical traditions that go into the makeup of those maps. The Chinese maps are graphic, but they don't use the same combination of graphic elements and text that you might find in European maps. There's not the same emphasis on mathematical scale and spatial relationships. Often that's left to textual description. So the way that Chinese cartographers manipulate space, it's not mathematical. It doesn't correspond necessarily to the shape of terrain, or even perhaps administrative districts.
Good day.
Thank you. Thanks for coming out.
Oh, no problem. You're interested in showing me around your exhibit?
Yeah, sure, if you want. What would you like to know?
Well, I mean, first of all, I guess, what is your deep interest in collecting all these Chinese maps?
Well, it's as I said in the catalog, is I started by having an interest in the history of how things are done in different cultures, and particularly in Chinese culture, because of the work of Joseph Needham at Cambridge University. And so I came across some artifacts, and I started picking them up, and then it just took off from there. I'm a collector by nature, and there are just some interesting and beautiful things.
So, do you want to take me to something that you find really compelling?
This map is probably the most unauspicious piece in the collection. It doesn't look pretty or anything. And when I got it, I knew it was of a river source, and I knew that there was engineering work being done on the river. What I didn't know until it came to this collection is that it's actually the Great Canal. And it was a report by the chief engineer of the work he had done on the canal to the Emperor of China. And I just love it, because that's exactly what why I was interested, is finding pieces that showed how things were done in another culture versus our own European culture. So this piece, it may not strike you when you look at it, but in fact, I think it speaks to why I started this collection.
Can you describe it?
Well, it's a section of the Great Canal that they were working on, where they were remediating some of the locks, because in fact the Great Canal was built many centuries before the work that was done on this. And it shows the different locks that are being put in, and the landings that are along the canal that they engineered and repaired. So, it's very good. And the other interesting thing is, if you compare it to today's engineering work, if you had a civil engineering doing this work, they still find time to put decoration on it. So there is some decorative elements to it, which shows that the beauty of the piece is is as important.
I wanted to take a look at a couple other things over here. Yeah, can you describe this, what we're seeing here?
Sure. We're looking at an album that unfolds. It's a long horizontal format, a continuous map of a coast of Taiwan. So it's essentially a kind of cinematic gazetteer that tells you of the important inhabited places from a Chinese perspective. It tells you in cartouches with inscriptions what the products of these places are, sometimes about local officials. Of course, this is from the coast of Taiwan that the Qing were able to control. On the mountainous far side of Taiwan, which was largely under Aboriginal control, the Qing didn't really have effective control, and so it doesn't show up on this map.
That's really interesting, because you can see the mountains kind of on the horizon of this map, and it just ends.
That's right.
And so when I looked at this, I didn't think of it as a map initially, because it's looking just kind of down the coast. It's more of a landscape painting.
It's halfway between a planimetric map that gives you sort of a bird's eye view looking downward, and something where you're floating maybe from a 45 degree angle.
And so there's like a political reason maybe for choosing this perspective on the map, because they didn't control the mountains, so why map it?
That's an interesting interpretation. This way of representing mountains as peaks that are relatively flat and piled up one on top of each other is a very archaic way of rendering mountains. Taiwan didn't become a part of China until relatively late in Chinese history. So there is a kind of implicit claim of the antiquity of this now Chinese territory with this very old painting style.
So it's a way of trying to claim it.
I think so. That's not stated explicitly. That's something that one teases out of visual clues, and I think are there in the original work and would have been understood by the people who made it, the officials who had this drawn up, maybe who even painted it, and then who read it as an official report. Nowadays, our task is to try to figure out just what that visual language, that symbolism was, and how to interpret it reveal all of its meanings.
Now you have a map over here. You have a map over here, Putoshan.
I love these two maps together, you know, because they're of the same area. And this is a sacred place for Buddhists. Why I love these is, again, they're functional. These were made for the tourist trade. So if you were a pilgrim and you went to the this particular location, this shrine, then these would be the maps. They were produced maybe 100 years apart, and you can see the change in the area from the two maps. And it just struck me, you know, we know about the tourist trade today and everything that goes around with it, and to think that hundreds of years ago there were people picking up maps to take a look at the place they'd been to or bring it home as a souvenir is to me, it was really phenomenal.
Go ahead.
No, that's fine.
I've actually been to Putoshan.
Oh, is that
and,
right?
And I have a map that I took home with me. Yeah, it's definitely not as nice looking as these two, though.
No, but I should have it in my collection to show the complete evolution of how it's gone. I've never been there either, so you're one step ahead of me. There's another map we should look at, though, and that is the spectacular one from the point of view of its appearance. Mm-hmm. The All Under Heaven map, which the cartography was probably...
It's an example of a genre of Chinese maps called complete maps of All Under Heaven. All Under Heaven means both the realm of the Chinese emperor and also the whole world. And in these maps, in this genre, you have effectively a rectangular space that's for the most part filled with China. And then floating around China on the margins are islands. Sometimes they're real islands like Japan. Sometimes they're mythological islands, like...
The immortals were supposed to live out in
the islands of the immortals, Peng Lai, or fanciful ones from ancient, or very old descriptions of foreign geography. And these islands are scattered around without any real interest in their geographic relationship with China. It's completely haphazard where they're placed. The main idea is that China is the center. It's the important thing. It's the center of all culture. And everything else is meant to be on the margins, and that shows its relative importance.
What I loved about this map was it so depicts China's attitude towards the rest of the world. So this is supposed to be a map of the world, and yet the European countries are shown as just little islands off in the top left of the corner. And Japan is just this little island over on the side and something called America on the other side. They weren't too sure of what it was. And so this map really shows why China is known as, the center. And the Chinese symbol for China is the center. Because they truly did believe that they were the center of the universe, as we all do. As we all do. Every culture believes they're the center and everything revolves around them. But this map certainly highlights it for China.
The land mass is planimetric. It looks like you're looking down on it from space. And yet we have lots of waves in the water that look like waves seen from an angle. They look kind of like a painting.
Right.
So there's a combination of different perspectives. And because there isn't the same type of mathematical regulation of space and perspective as you would find in a European map of this time, of the 18th or the 19th century, there's a kind of freedom that allows the Chinese cartographer to do that.
Yeah, and I see that more of that kind of painterly touch is on the margins. Uh-huh. And then China, which is the real part, is more schematic.
There is a combination of painterly elements, signs that help to contextualize China's political organization and its value. So, for example, this map purports to spell out the administrative organization of the emperor's domain. It's well regulated. Everything is recognized and situated in relation to the capital, in relation to the political center. And that's done schematically through the titles of places. And yet around in the water on the islands, we have something that's a bit more pictorial. Painting, of course, is a high art form, and it gives us a kind of cultural cachet in the way that perhaps maps before the 19th century in Europe were illuminated with elaborate cartouches. Mm. Here, even the color scheme imbues the map with a kind of cultural luster and a comment about Chinese power. The map is done primarily in deep blue and a green color, a mineral green, with white text left in reserve. That's a reference to a very old painting style from the 8th century or so. It's called the blue and green painting style, and it was popular at the court, a general at the court. So for this print, this map, to use that combination of colors is to make a kind of reference to that courtly painting style from an era when China was very powerful. In the 7th century and the 8th century, China was one of the global superpowers, controlled the Silk Route, and traded with the Middle East. And so this map brings that kind of reference, that visual clue, into a statement of 19th century China's power, and is making a claim about how the rulers of that time were just as powerful and impressive.
But this is a beautiful map. It was probably actually printed around 1823, maybe 50 years after the cartography was done. And I believe I only know of two other maps from this cartography. One hangs in the Beijing Library in the entrance, and the other is at the Library of Congress, and this is a third copy of it.
So how did you acquire this map?
This map came to me through an agent from London, England. When I acquired the map, they told me that it had been found in a Japanese warehouse, and they believe it had been sitting there since about 1902. And that's why it's in such immaculate condition, is that it was probably forgotten in a box and stayed there for 80 years until someone opened it up and saw it, and it came to market.
Did you tell people that you were interested in maps and that's why they came to you?
Well, you know, it's such a narrow group of people who are interested in Chinese language at that time. Now there's lots of people interested in it, but when I was collecting it 15 years ago, very few people were interested. So if someone had something like this, there was only a handful of people that would probably be interested in acquiring it. And as soon as you acquire a little bit, the network goes out and everybody knows you're someone who's likely to be a buyer. So it quickly finds its way to your doorstep. I had lots of it, and a couple of pieces I wished I'd bought and I didn't, and one that...
One that got away?
Yeah, one that got away. It was a beautiful map like this, actually. It was, but it was an original map by the Jesuit Matteo Ricci. He was the first European allowed in the Forbidden City because of his knowledge of mathematics. And he was the first person to draw a map using European cartography techniques of China, and he did it in the Chinese language. It was 8 scrolls again, just like this one is 8 scrolls. Really bad condition. Two of the pieces were hardly even recognizable. And I didn't understand at that time how good paper conservation could be. Somebody bought it. They paid a bit of money for it, but somebody bought it, and they had the conservation work done, and it came back onto the market about 8 times the price. Just a beautiful piece. So yeah, some of them get away on you. Walter, he's got a question for the two of us.
Oh!
It's going to take two of us to answer it.
Let's do it.
Absolutely.
I just wanted to know how the two of you worked together, what that experience was like, how you approached it.
Actually, Walter came out to visit me at my house, and I started hauling stuff out of closets and laying it out on the floor, and he kept oohing and aahing over it. And then he went away, and I started packing it up and sending it to him. And I'm just amazed that he was able to put it all together in a way that reflected why I had done everything that I had done, because we actually didn't spend that much time together.
Not personally.
No.
I feel as though we've communed a bit. Mm-hmm. And Floyd is very modest, as I'm sure you've already learned. I think it takes real courage to make public something that one has amassed painstakingly and privately over a long period of time, and to let people whom you barely know inspect it and talk about it and present it to the public. That's a very generous and courageous thing to do, and not everyone can do it. I find it hard to let go of, you know, my worthless things, much less treasures such as these. So to just let them be studied and published for public inspection is quite a gesture and a step.
And Walter's being modest, because I tell you, when I got the draft of his catalog, I just couldn't believe it. I learned so much about my collection. I learned more about my collection in the 15 years that I owned it. You know, because he had the background. He had the knowledge to be able to go in and do this.
How did you try to come up with something that fit what you thought Floyd's vision would be?
Well, Floyd's vision is a quiet one. It is one that puts things together in an uncommon way and lets you make connections without shoving a viewpoint on you. There's definitely a coherence to the way these fit together and the way they reflect and illuminate each other. And it took me a while of thinking about the individual parts and researching them and then trying to see how they fit into their historical context to understand how Floyd's interest in technology, in various cultures, ways of representing practical things like topography and waterworks, things like that, really gives us a very multi-dimensional picture of China that's very uncommon. He's not going to force that down our throats, but if you spend time in the show and compare works to each other, you'll see lots of elements in individual works that show up in other works. Multiple versions of the same type of cartographic genre, different, showing you different tweakings of the idea. Multiple references to Chinese beliefs about things like auspicious tiger imagery that show up in military manuals and popular representations. We get a really rich sense of late imperial Chinese culture that you don't get from exhibitions, from collections that focus very narrowly on, say, scholarly painting or just on calligraphy or something like that. So there's a kind of intelligence behind there that brings these diverse things together, and in the clever joinery of them all, there's a picture and a story to be told.
And so what's your plan for your collection in the future?
Well, this is about 40% of the collection that I have. I have a large photographic collection as well. Working with the University of Alberta, I hope to, put it into a number of other venues in Alberta so people can see it. And then we're hoping to take it to Hong Kong and Singapore. And eventually I would like to find a public place for it where, you know, people can have access to it, because sitting at my home is really inappropriate, particularly now that I've seen what the University of Alberta has done with it. There's a lot more value in this for scholars and whatnot than I realized, and so they should have access to it. One of the things we have done as part of this project is I've had extremely high resolution scans done of every piece, and so they're going to be available to scholars. If they can't see the originals, then they can have access to the electronic media. And so that's what it needs to be done. It needs to be put back, and maybe even put back to the Chinese people. It's their cultural heritage. They probably should have it eventually.
Well, I'm really glad that both of you shared your thoughts and feelings and helped guide me through this exhibition.
Thank you, Trevor. I really appreciate your interest.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.